grown, son. Expression screwed up with fear, he rocked back and forth in his chair.
That's why I'm here then, huh? That's why you brought me here? Some sick fucking revenge plot?
You're too brilliant.
I never meant to hurt any kid, had I known that they were gonna torture him.
You'd have what? I tipped my head, watching the man spew lies as easily as if they were truth. Saved him? Called the police? Done what any decent human being would have done? I let out a mirthless chuckle. No, I don't think so, Mr. Barletta. You're shit. Food for the worms.
What do you want? You gotta want something.
It so happens I do. And now is the time to request it, before your brain begins to deteriorate.
What?
He fell out of the chair onto his knees and gripped the bars of his cell.
Anything. I'll do anything.
Unimpressed with his plea, I watched with an air of disgust as the man shed his worthless tears. The reason I brought you here is simple. I need a name. A name only you can give me.
Who? Who?
It seems I was too late getting to Victor Rossi, one of the two associates who transported my brother. He unfortunately passed of a heart attack. The others succumbed rather quickly to the worms, but not before he offered up your name. So it's up to you, Mr. Barletta, to tell me the name of the man you handed my brother off to.
You're talking, what, almost 20 years ago?
He released the cell bars, slouching in defeat.
How the fuck would I remember that?
I don't know. From the inside pocket of my coat, I pulled a capped syringe and held it up for him to see. This is the antidote that will keep you from dying. I suggest you remember. And if you lie to me, you can kiss it goodbye.
Ah, Jesus. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what the fuck?
He rubbed a hand down his face.
Victor Rossi. Yeah, I know the name. So, the guy was...
Frowning, he seemed to think hard on the name, desperate to remember.
From New York, it was... Angelo! Angelo De Luca!
You're certain of this?
Yeah, the guy was a prick. I can see his face clear as day.
His eyes lit with a sickening hope that I was all too eager to snuff.
His nose was crooked like he'd been punched too many times, and he had a nasty scar at his eye.
Amazing what a person could remember under the right circumstances. I made a mental note of the name, my next test subject. So you're going to sit tight while I do some research on Mr. De Luca.
What about these worms, man? I can't take them moving around inside of me. It's freaking me the fuck out.
I shrugged with a smile. Hopefully I'll find him fairly easily. But before I begin this goose chase... You're absolutely certain this is the guy.
Yes, I swear on my own fucking grave, it's him. Please, get these goddamn things out of me.
I pushed up from the chair and straightened my slacks, unaffected by his desperation. I had no intentions of helping him. The syringe I lifted held nothing more than sterile saline. I'll let you know how the research goes.
Please hurry, man. I can't take this shit anymore.
Rubbing his skull, he rocked back and forth on the floor.
I can't. It's fucking with my head.
Yes, it does fuck with your head. That is the nature of it. We'll speak soon, Mr. Barletta. Enjoy your evening.
Enjoy? Enjoy my fucking evening? In a prison? Where's my water? I want my water.
Ah. Yes, I almost forgot. I strode down the hallway where a plastic cup sat beside a hose that I'd fed down into the lower levels. I twisted it on and filled the cup half full, about twice the amount I'd given him every other time. His eyes lit up when I returned with it, his hands outstretched through the bars of his cell.
Please,
he said in a shaky voice, carefully accepting the drink, and he took a hearty sip. His brows pinched to a frown, and he opened his mouth. As if to gag. A long black worm slithered past his lips into the cup, and he slowly lowered it with trembling hands, eyes wide and panicked.
Oh, fuck, he whispered in a shaky voice. Oh, fucking hell.
I reached through the bars, urging him to pass it to me. As if in a trance, he didn't take his eyes off the cup as he handed it over.
This,
he swallowed a gulp and stifled another gag.
This is what's inside me?
Holding up the scant bit of water left of the naked bulb, I studied the worm coiled at the bottom of it, noting the teeth that attempted to latch at the surface. Yes, it seems they've evolved. He slapped a hand over his mouth, breathing hard through his nose.
I don't want to throw up. I'm afraid more of those fuckers will fly out.
Yes, it's better to keep them contained. Otherwise, they'll try to get away. I lowered the cup and turned back to Barletta, who crouched in the corner of his cell, shaking.
You're not right in the head, are you? Ain't no way you're right in the head.
The sound of my chuckle echoed down the corridor. Says the man who beat his son with a bottle?
I was drunk. I would never intentionally hurt someone. But this is sick.
Sighing, I stared down into the cup at the fully grown worm, one who'd spent the last few weeks feeding on the man's liver. I suppose you're right. Must have been all those knocks to the skull. I tapped a finger to my temple. Have a look at what happens when you beat your children.
You're not letting me go.
Head tipped in disbelief of the man's ignorance, I snorted a laugh. Is that what you thought? That our time together would end with me setting you free? I'm afraid not. Whimpering, he rocked back and forth, his hands running across his skull.
I was in a bad place when I was working for those assholes who took your brother. I'm not there anymore.
That's great. Truly. I suspect the next time we chat, you'll be a bit preoccupied. He stilled and looked up at me, the desperation in his eyes almost laughable.
With what?
Trying not to vomit your own bowels. I strode back down the corridor, and at the sound of Barletta's outcry, I smirked, glancing over my shoulder. Something caught my eye. A shadowy figure at the opposite corridor passed Barletta's cell. Frowning, I turned around, examining the shape, and walked back in that direction, until I was standing in front of Barletta once again. The figure didn't move. He only stood staring, mostly hidden by the shadows. Who's there? I called out.
Someone's there? You see someone?
Barletta slammed himself into the bars of the cage and reached out for my coat.
Get me out of here, Doc! I want out!
Scowling, I looked down to see his fingers curled into my coat, and I pried him loose. When I lifted my gaze again, the shadowy figure was gone. To be sure, I strode closer, the cup holding the worm still clutched in my hand. Nothing but the empty corridor stood ahead of me, brimming with the sound of Barletta's screams.
Chapter 32. Lilia. After 2 hours of gathering snippets from various articles and studies on symbiosis as an evolutionary perspective for Gilchrist's upcoming essay exam, I was sick of it. Freaking sick of it. Who knew beneficial relationships between insects could be so boring? At least Bramwell's class offered a bit of horror and action with his mind-controlling parasites. As I eased back in my chair, I caught sight of Mel hustling past my open dorm room door. Strange thing, university. At home, I'd always kept my door closed, hating the lack of privacy. At Dracadia, I welcomed the occasional hello as one of my floor mates breezed past. They were often respectful enough not to enter and never came off as particularly nosy or caring of what I kept in my room. Maybe that was why I didn't mind. Mel, I called out, knocking over the coffee cup I'd left on the floor beside my chair so that I wouldn't knock it off my desk. Shit. Nabbing some Kleenex from the box beside my laptop, I knelt down and daubed it, not immediately noticing she'd stopped at my door. What's up? She asked, leaning against the doorframe. Abandoning the sopping tissues, I wiped my wet hands on the skirt of my dress and pushed to my feet. Hey, can I ask you a few questions? With a frantic wave of my hand, I corralled her inside my room and closed the door behind her. Sure. It's about the Crixon Project. See, I work in the library and, well, I can't find anything on it. The librarian I work with says there are some texts, but they're off limits. Those texts are useless and meaningless. Useless and meaningless? Meaning what? She had better information? So, how do you know so much? Why do you want to know? Telling her that I had suspicions about Andrea Kepling and the nature of the experiment led by Professor Bramwell's father would have been laying too many of my own cards down at once. I wanted to see what she had on it first. I find myself questioning Professor Bramwell's current research. I lowered my voice. I don't trust him. You and everyone else. Okay, seemed I needed a bigger bargaining chip. I know what happened to one of the participants who escaped. How? Instead of answering, I shook my head. Had she known it was Spencer who'd informed me, I doubted she'd have given it much merit. She stared at me for a moment, her jaw shifting, contemplating. Come to my dorm tonight and I'll show you. Just like that. I thought I'd have had to do something crazy, like sacrifice a goat to get her to tell me the information, but there she was, offering it up like free booze at communion. Okay, what time? After 10. A knock on the door interrupted us, and frowning, I opened the door to find a strange blonde wearing fancy threads that, to my untrained eye, looked designer. The harder lines in her face put her at about 40 or so, but her hair and dress gave her a sense of youth. I caught the twitch of her lip as she gave a quick once-over, clearly examining my less impressive outfit. "Miss Vespertine?" she asked, like the name left a bitter taste on her tongue. "Yes, I'm Missy Finch. I own the boutique in Emberwick. Mr. Spencer Lippincott sent me to measure you for a dress." The air deflated out of me at the reminder that I'd committed myself to that charity event with him. Oh, God. Spencer. The air of disgust in Mel's voice had me flinching. Not that I cared that she had something against him, but the timing was a bit off. I didn't need her clamming up when I was on the brink of getting somewhere in my nosy inquiries. Are you seriously hanging out with that guy? He's a creep. The blonde's gaze snapped to Mel's, and judging by the repulsed expression on her face, it seemed that Lippincott was more than some rando who'd sent her over to measure me. I beg your pardon. Look, it's a misunderstanding. I intercepted before an all-out brawl could break out in my dorm room. Miss Finch, I appreciate you dropping by, but I don't need you to measure me. Her bright blue eyes flared with indignity. I came all the way over here, leaving my boutique unattended, battling the tyrant at the gate, and now suffering insult to a family friend. On a huff of irritation, Mel stormed out of my room, and I turned my attention back to the blonde. My apologies. Can you just give me a minute? She crossed her arms and gave a haughty tip of her chin. Only a minute. I chased after Mel, who'd only gotten about three doors down from me. Wait. Can you please tell me what the hell is up with Spencer, that you hate him so much? I get it. You don't give a shit what the freak has to say. Go off and enjoy your little romance with the provost's privileged son. Emo Jesus in a black dress. I didn't have the patience for her right now. I give everyone the benefit of the doubt, including you, just as I wouldn't give a shit what someone had to say about you without finding out myself. I'd like to be my own judge where he's concerned. Then find out by yourself. But don't say I didn't warn you. And what about meeting up? Are we still on for that? A furtive glance around and she leaned closer to me. You're asking for sensitive information. Why the hell should I trust you when you so openly trust others? Because you still want to know what I know? And I never said I fully trusted Spencer. Where I come from, spilling secrets gets you killed. As is the case here. She ran her tongue over her teeth and, arms crossed, studied me again like she needed to internally ask her other moods for permission first. I don't know why I bother with you, Vespertine. Maybe because you're not a pretentious little trust fund bitch. But you still annoy the shit out of me. Is that a yes, then? She rolled her eyes and huffed. Yeah, I guess. Thank goodness. Breathing a sigh of relief, I returned to my room to find Missy rummaging through the dresses hung in my closet. Hey! It's not that you're entirely tasteless, mind you. It's just, well, you have no sense of balance. I have balance. She studied me for what felt like minutes, her eye squinting on occasion as if in disapproval of whatever thoughts ran through her head. You remind me of someone. Are you related to the Corbins at all? No, but you're the second person who's asked. It's uncanny. The hair. She motioned to her own, wearing a frown as if there was something wrong with mine. The face, the eyes. It's like I'm staring right at her again. Who? An old classmate of mine, Vanessa Corbin. She lived here on the island for a number of years. But she looks like me? A spitting image? Waving her hand in dismissal, she shook her head. Let's get this over with, shall we? I'll take measurements back to my shop and see what dress would best complement your figure. Wait. I threw up my hands at that. I don't get to pick the dress? She glanced toward my outfit and back. I don't think that's a good idea. Well, I happen to be very particular about what I wear, and I'm not really in the position to spend... She threw up a hand, refusing to hear what I had to say. The cost is inconsequential. As I said, the Lippincotts are friends. Okay, fine, but I'd like to try it on first before the event. I refuse to wear anything that makes me uncomfortable. No, can do, darling. Depending on the dress, adjustments could take me right up until the night of. Fine. If it happened that I hated the dress, I'd wear one of my own, or fake being sick. Either way, the woman was not about to dictate what I wore. As she took hold of my shoulders and urged me upright, her gaze landed somewhere on my neck and she frowned, lifting up the small vial of my mother's ashes, dangling from its beaded chain there. What's this? It belonged to my mother, I answered lamely. It'll have to go. The night of the gala. It certainly won't pair well with any dress I provide. I groaned and shook my head. Okay, can we just get to measuring? For the next 20 minutes, she must have taken about 100 different measurements, as if she was about to clone a 3-dimensional version of myself back at her shop. With impatience, I let her do her thing, mildly irritated by the slow-mo pace in which she moved. When she finally finished and left my room, I was actually eager to jump back into the symbiosis of insects. And I would have dove headfirst back into those studies if I hadn't caught sight of Professor Bramwell reading beneath the tree in the courtyard. Unusual, seeing as he rarely spent a moment outside of his office or lab, from what I'd observed over the last couple of weeks. That the guy had to be utterly delectable with a book in his hands made me want to scratch my eyeballs out. I snacked on an apple as I sat on my windowsill, staring down at him, hating that my determination to focus had been completely derailed by the man again. Yes, a man. Not a boy. Not a classmate. My professor, whom I found myself thinking about far more than I should have. What started as a curiosity over what he was reading quickly turned to thoughts of what it must have felt like to be the sole object of his focus, like that book. I imagined him to be intense, passionately reading every page, desperate to soak up as many of the words as he could. Staring intently, I ran my thumb over my bottom lip, imagining it caught between his teeth. All at once, he lifted his gaze, eyes locked on mine. On a squawk of humiliation, I startled and fell off the windowsill, crashing onto the floor below me. A zap of pain shot up from my ass into my spine, and I grimaced, rubbing the cheek that had taken the brunt of the fall. Classy. Real classy. Chapter 33. Lilia. Tick, tick, tick. I hawked the clock until at precisely 10:08, I headed out for Mel's dorm room. The hallways were never quiet, always bustling with late-night study sessions. The commons room at the end of the hallway buzzed with the same physics students cramming for another exam, just as they had the week before. Each of them made obvious because they plastered the chalkboard with their equations and often yelled, "Bazinga!" from the Big Bang Theory, whenever they solved it correctly. It was the only time the entire corridor smelled like weed, too. When I reached Mel's room, I only had to knock once before the door swung open, and she peered out into the hallway, looking left and right. A hard yank of my arm had me tumbling forward into the room. "Hey, a simple come in would have worked," I scowled, rubbing the raw spot where her nails had dug into my skin, and glanced around her room, significantly bigger than mine, with a small living room and a hallway that I presumed led to a bedroom. Ignoring my complaint, she jerked her head for me to follow. and led me down a small hallway to a door she swung open on a bedroom, as I'd suspected. What I hadn't expected was for her to lead me to another door, a closet, where at its rear stood yet another small door. "What in the wannabe Narnia is this?" I asked, staring at the frame which appeared to be half the size of a normal door. "Decades ago, when the dorm was first built, it housed children, like an orphanage. The settlers were terrified of the savage monsters," she said in air quotes, "coming and taking the children in the middle of the night. So they built these little doorways leading to the cellars to hide them in the event of a raid. I'm guessing the raids never happened?" "You guessed right." Hinges groaned as she opened the door on a creepy stone stairwell, and from the shelf of her closet she nabbed an LED lamp. "Come on, gang's waiting to meet you." "Gang?" Hopefully that wasn't crazy talk for a pile of dead bodies. I followed her down the staircase, where the air grew thicker and colder. Rubbing my shoulders failed to keep the chill off my skin, and when we finally reached the bottom of the stairs, shivers racked my bones. "Jesus, you should have given me a heads up to wear a sweatshirt." "Don't be a wimp." Tiny bells on her bohemian skirt clinked as she led me down a narrow corridor off the staircase that curved to the left. I couldn't help but think how freaking creepy it would have been to stumble upon something while wandering the passage alone. "What made you want to explore down here? I feel like this is the perfect place to hide dead bodies." An impish curve of her lips told me Mel definitely had a dark side as she glanced over her shoulder, leaving me to wonder if I was stupid for having followed after her. "The dead have stories," she said. "Have you had any encounters yet?" "What, like ghosts?" Of course I had. A man in a bird mask, though I hadn't yet worked out if he was the result of too little sleep or real. Either way, I had no intentions of mentioning him. "Yes, the whole campus is plagued with hauntings, but this building, it's the worst." "Why is that? The Crickson study?" "In part, yes." She kept on down the dark hallway while my gaze wandered the ancient stone walls that seemed to close in on us the deeper we ventured. Again, I couldn't imagine her exploring down there by herself. "In addition to the experiments, it's also where exorcisms were conducted on kids, back when the place was a monastery. Apparently, some of the builders who worked on the university were superstitious about all that, so about a third of the crew left, and others refused to venture into these little passages. So they were never properly investigated and got sealed." "The exorcisms. Is that during the time of Dr. Sterling?" "You've read about him?" "Yes." The memory of my readings and the tortures he inflicted certainly didn't put me at ease as we walked through the tunnels. "So, in the mid to late 1700s, the place was sort of a dumping ground for heretics and those accused of witchcraft. They sent anyone with mental illness here, as well, thinking they were possessed. In the early 1800s, an asylum opened. That's when things got really disturbing." "How so?" "They began torturing the patients and discarded them in mass graves on what is now Bone Bay. These hideout tunnels became solitary confinement for a number of patients, where they were starved and left to die." "Jesus, that's messed up. How do you know all of this?" She shrugged, running her hands over a stretch of wall that, when I looked closer, appeared to bear scratch marks in the stone. "I spend way too much time reading. But also there was an investigator back in the 1800s who disguised himself as a patient. Before he mysteriously disappeared, he apparently sent one of his friends encrypted journal entries that detailed the tortures he'd witnessed. They're part of the no-access journals in the library." "So how did you get access? I work in that department and can't get my hands on them." "My father is a massive donor for the library and chairman of the Board of Overseers. Administration and board members have access to just about anything. And Kelvin, but there's no bargaining with him. He's too much of a straight shooter." The corridor finally opened up on a moderately sized circular room with no windows or doors. A shiver spiraled down my spine as I imagined being trapped there, like the patients she'd mentioned. Candles lit the space where three others sat on large, multicolored cushions. An Asian guy with pink hair, a young woman with short black pixie hair and tawny skin, and a collection of piercings in her ears, nose, lip, and eyebrow. And Bryson, who tipped back a fifth of what I recognized as Jack Daniels.
"Lilia,
he said, in a more spirited tone than the last time I'd seen him. With a slight smile, I waved. Hey. The pink-haired guy crossed his arms, eyeing me up and down.
So, you brought fresh blood, Mal?
This is Lilia. Lilia, this is Ken. Pink hair waved a hand over himself, then lit up what I guessed to be a joint, given the way he held it between thumb and forefinger and took a puff. Seems you already know Bryson, and this is Catalina, who we call Cat for short. In response to her unenthusiastic wave, I gave a curt nod, and the dark-haired girl went back to reading the book in her hands. Squinting, I could just make out The Antichrist by Nietzsche on its cover. A bottle of Patron sat in the middle of the circle, which Mel swiped up and poured into a shot glass. She kicked back the mouthful, filled the glass again, and handed it off to me. With a shake of my head, I declined, and she shrugged, tipping back a second shot. Scattered about the room sat beaten-up boxes filled with manila folders and two laptops. Other equipment lay about that I didn't recognize. Electronics of some sort that Bryson tinkered with, between stealing sips of whiskey. What is this? I asked, gaze wandering their secret little gathering space. Welcome to Anonymous. Mel slumped onto one of the open cushions and flicked her fingers toward Ken, who passed the joint to her. Wait, what? That's you? Yeah. We're kind of the underground version of Snopes here at the university. Voice hoarse, she blew off the smoke and passed the joint to me. Again, I declined, and she shrugged, handing it to Kat instead. If it's true, we dig up facts. If it's false, we find proof to back that. So when I asked you about the Crixon Project... Never taking her eyes off mine, Mel stretched toward Bryson that time and flicked her fingers. From one of the banker's boxes, he grabbed a stack of folders and handed them over. These files were stolen by two computer science majors back in 2005. They hid the files down here, never speaking of them. Both were expelled the following year. But since then, this has become a dumping ground for inaccessible information. Hasn't the school caught on to that? Not yet. Pushing up from the cushion, she crossed the room, flipping through the files. So I suggest whatever facts you're looking for, now's the time to dig. And when you're done, you'll tell me what you supposedly know about one of the participants. She shoved the folders against my chest and sat back down beside Kat, who still didn't bother to put her book down. Strange that she didn't require me to offer up my end of the deal first. I took a seat on the floor beside one of the candles at the opposite end of the room and laid the folders out in front of me. No idea why the hell I was so nervous, like opening a vault of dead bodies. Oddly enough, it was when I cracked open the first folder that a cold dread brushed the back of my neck. Rubbing my hand over it failed to settle the disturbing feeling, especially when I flipped the first enclosed paper over to reveal a slightly familiar face.
Warren Bramwell?
Bryson said from beside me, alerting me that he'd moved from across the room.
Dr. Deaths.
Father, yes, I can tell. The eyes may have been a different color, his hair lighter and peppered in gray that hadn't yet touched his son's, but their relation was undeniable. His eyes held the same striking intensity, as if he were peering into the soul. Handsome was an understatement, but perhaps that made up his sinister charm.
The university's very own Dr. Sterling.
As Bryson spoke, I skimmed through the incident report, which must have been taken by a representative of the university. The way it praised his credentials and work. His background was endocrinology?
Yes. As I understand, his wife had battled diabetes since childhood. He hoped to cure it for her.
I flipped the page to a picture of a young, dark-skinned woman clipped to what I recognized as a medical chart. Yolanda Murdoch, aged 29, with a history of insulin-dependent diabetes. Another flip of the page, another woman clipped to a medical report. The next one was a blonde, 30 years of age, who also suffered from diabetes. Same with the next, and the next, and the next. After skimming the medical record of all six women, I kept on through the file to where I found a synopsis of the experiment. Objective: to evaluate the efficacy and safety of Nubrem-1 toxin on type 1 diabetes management in routine clinical practice. Secondary objective: demographic and biometric data, treatment compliance, adverse drug reactions. Methodology: serial injections of Nubrem-1 purified toxin over a period of 6 months. Efficacy measured by increased beta cell mass and insulin levels. At a glance, the summary painted a picture of legitimacy. Included were detailed graphs that displayed the incremental dosages given to the participants and the symptoms they reported. Digestive changes, hallucinations, sensitivity to light. I frowned, reading through the report. What the hell had the new Bram-1 toxin been purified from? The answer revealed itself on the next page. Purified toxin derived from Noctisoma larvae. I knew it. I knew Bramwell Sr. had had some dealing with Noctisoma. An adverse event table detailed more symptoms. Horrific symptoms of suicidal ideation, night terrors. One of the women stabbed herself in the stomach, claiming she had felt something moving around inside her. Another suffered hallucinations of her dead daughter after she'd refused to eat, telling her that she had to feed the babies inside of her. I flipped quickly for the outcome of the experiment and found it in a police report, for which an autopsy had been performed on the women after their bodies had been pulled from the lake. All of them had died by mass suicide. The coroner had come to that conclusion based on ongoing mental disturbances documented in the study and no evidence of foul play. The women had apparently submerged themselves into freezing waters willingly. Two of them showed signs of stroke. All of them likely suffered hypothermia due to winter temperatures. I folded the file shut to grab another when something fell from inside. A picture. In it stood three men dressed in lab coats. One I recognized as Dr. Warren Bramwell. The other was Dr. Lippincott. I had never seen the third man before. They flanked eight women whose faces I scanned over. My gaze landed on one of the women. A familiar face. Too familiar. The picture slipped from my fingers. My heart hammered like a drum against my ribs. Ribbons of panic wrapped themselves around my lungs and squeezed. I took hold of the vial at my collarbone and ran my thumb over the surface of it.
What is it?
Bryson asked beside me, breaking me from my shocked spell. He lifted the picture from the floor, bringing her to my attention once more. Hand trembling, I pointed to the woman. Third from the right. That's my mother. Wait, you know her? Mel strode from across the room, plopping down beside me. I have a picture back in my room. Yes, that's my mom. Holy shit. She snatched the picture from Bryson, staring down at what I couldn't bring myself to look at again. I was aware of Andrea, thanks to her little tantrum with Lippincott a few weeks back. Not sure if they ever found her after that. We've not been able to track down any information on the last one, though, aside from her intake sheet. It's believed that she and Andrea are the two that left the study, but there's nothing on them. What name have you searched? The toneless cadence of my voice mirrored the shock still pulsing through me. I felt like I was caught up in some suspended state of reality, like I'd slipped underwater and taken a breath. Vanessa Corbin. Andrea is actually June Galloway. The locals tell me both of them lived on this island. Lived on the island? My mother? I knew her as Francesca Vespertine. My mom. Mel tipped her head, as if just then catching on that I wasn't processing the news well. You okay? You look pale. I didn't know how to answer that. Was I okay? Not particularly. My brain didn't know where to begin piecing things together. So many flitting strings clamoring inside my head, all of them in need of tying before my brain would settle. And I couldn't. I couldn't tie the pieces together because they didn't make any sense to me. Fine, I lied. Where's your mom now? Where's your mom now? The question echoed inside my head, and my thoughts latched onto it like a lifeline. Dread clawed at my stomach, and an itch across my forearms had me scratching there, furiously scratching. She died 4 years ago. Both women are dead, actually. A hollow chill twisted in my gut, churning and gnashing with the stress of feeling like I'd been broken into, vandalized and robbed of what I'd come to know as truth. I felt numb, like a dream. It had to have been a dream. No way my mother would have done this to me, to us. Every memory ended on a question mark. Every story she'd told left me wondering how many had been fairy tales. You're certain that June is dead as well? Mel's questions remained a welcomed intrusion to the blackness pulling me in. The impossible void of not really knowing who I was in that moment. June, Andrea, the names tangled inside my head. As I understand. How do you know this? I didn't answer because it was none of her business. Okay, can I ask how your mom died? Mel looked away, the expression on her face a delicate balance of empathy and intrigue. If you don't want to share the details, that's okay. I understand. Suicide. In the bathtub, I said coldly, and squeezed my eyes shut on the images flashing inside my head. Mama, please stop. I cleared my throat and shook my head in an attempt to bat the echo of voices away. Don't you find that a little fucked up? From her perspective, it probably seemed that way. From mine, it made absolute sense, given what I knew about the organism and the way it hijacked the mind. It wanted a water source to mate and breed more eggs. What made absolute zero sense to me was how my mother had ended up infected, if these women were supposedly only injected with a purified toxin. And why, after 20 years, would she have suffered symptoms? According to what I'd learned in Bramwell's class, they began fairly soon after infection. Was the toxin capable of mind control like that in the absence of the organism? Could it have delayed her infection somehow? Unfortunately, nobody in that cramped and suffocating room could likely answer that question. But one man undoubtedly knew. A heavy weight of exhaustion fell over me, pressing down on my shoulders. The burden of having to unravel a mystery that made no sense. What is your conclusion? I asked. That Bramwell Sr. killed all those women and had some connection to the pathologist who conveniently reported them as suicides for him. How would that look, after all, if Dracadia, the top medical research facility in the world, was plagued by a scandal where 6 women died and 2 went missing? It was plausible. Plausible and shady. I held out my hand for the picture again and turned it over to the date on the other side. January 9th, 2003. I was born November 13th of the same year. Was I the reason my mother had left the study? Had someone tried to keep her from leaving? Do you know if Bramwell Sr. is still alive? He's not. There was a big obituary in the Dracadian Gazette. He died maybe 8 years ago, before my time here. You can probably pull the obituary in the library records. Then I need to talk to his son about this. A rough shake of my arm dragged me from the trance I'd slipped into again. No. Are you fucking kidding me? Did you miss the part where I said these were stolen files? If my mother was a participant, if she died based on these experiments, then I have a right to get the answers. Kat groaned, snapping her book shut and setting it aside. I knew it was a bad idea inviting an outsider. For fuck's sake, she probably reads vampire smut. Shut up, Kat. Mel spat and turned her attention back to me. Look, I get it, okay? If it were my mom, I'd be all over that shit too. But you can't just walk up to the son of the psychopath who orchestrated all of this. If he's smart, he won't tell you a damn thing, and we all know Dr. Death isn't dumb. Or he wouldn't have gotten away with Jenny's disappearance the way he did. You honestly think he had something to do with that? I was her roommate, okay? And I can tell you there's no way she'd have just up and ran off. He knows what happened to her, just like he undoubtedly knows what happened to those women. But he's not going to tell you shit. These men are powerful. That power is the reason there isn't any information on these murders. They wipe it all out of existence. I had a feeling she might have been right about that. Meaning all those flitting strings in my head would forever wiggle and taunt me for answers I'd likely never find. I'm not stupid. I wouldn't outright ask him. Ask him what, anyway? You have your proof. She participated in the study. But she didn't die when they did. She died 4 years ago. What happened in that time? As if she could finally see my dilemma, Mel huffed and slouched against the wall. Well, what do you expect from him? Even if he knows the details of the study, do you think he'd come out and tell you? How the hell do you plan to ask that question? I don't know yet. I'd wanted to work as an assistant in his lab. She rolled her eyes at that. Yeah, good luck. He doesn't take assistants, and he sure as hell wouldn't want anything to do with a first year. Trust me, I know. I was so desperate to gain access to the missing files that I asked Ross out for coffee. She made a puking gesture, which I would have made a point to tell her was a bit dramatic, seeing as the guy wasn't ugly, except that my head still spun and I felt kind of sick myself. He's Bramwell's beloved TA, after all. He doesn't do dates, in case you decide to go that route. What files? I asked, ignoring her comment. The ones that describe the results of the toxin before these women committed suicide, she said in air quotes. There's a whole section of notes missing. Daily inoculations that weren't recorded. And what happened to this guy? She pointed to the one researcher in the photo that I couldn't identify. There's nothing on him either. As if he never existed. He's not even in the reports, neither is Lippincott. No surprise there. It made sense why Lippincott would have distanced himself from the botched project if he'd had aspirations to become provost one day. What didn't make sense, and what continued to plague my head through all of this speculation, was why my mother had expelled worms from her mouth, as if she'd somehow gotten infected. How? And why had her and Andrea just recently succumbed to the illness? Well, I guess it doesn't matter, I said. You're right. He doesn't take assistance. I already asked. Probably covering his ass. Jenny was dying to work on the Noctosoma project with him. It was all she talked about. He was all she talked about. Mel rolled her eyes again as if it troubled her that her roommate had been so taken with him. He refused her as well? I'm guessing so. She went to meet with him after the midnight lab. She was never seen again. And you're convinced it was Bramwell who had anything to do with that? CCTV cameras caught her leaving his secret lab. That was the last anyone saw her. If that was the extent that they had on the guy, it certainly wasn't enough to convince me that he'd murdered her. He barely gave me or any other girl in class the time of day, and I'd never seen him so much as react to those in class who very obviously flirted with him. Surely the university wouldn't have kept an accused murderer as a tenured professor. Was he ever arrested? Of course not. Are you kidding me? I had to figure out a way to get closer to him. Perhaps asking him for tutoring lessons, but he'd probably just direct me to Ross for that. There had to be another way. Somehow, Jenny Herrick had found her way to his lab, so it wasn't impossible. I just needed a hook. Something to draw him in. But considering the guy showed absolutely zero interest in any of the students, I'd probably have an easier time capturing the attention of aliens in space. Mel's finger prodded my arm, once again dragging me from thoughts. I swear on my dog's grave, if you tell anyone about this place or these files, you will regret it. Are we clear? Crystal. Good. And steer clear of Bramwell. They call him Dr. Death for a reason. While the mystery of Jenny Herrick's disappearance was certainly a draw, as it related to Professor Bramwell, the bigger curiosity for me was Bramwell Sr. I needed to know more about those experiments and what had happened to my mother. If he'd played some role in her death. The file I'd read made me question everything. It couldn't have been a mere coincidence that the woman in that picture looked exactly like my mother. The more horrifying thought plaguing my brain was that everything I'd come to know about my mother appeared to be a lie. Where she'd come from, who she'd been. Had she lied about her parents as well? Was it possible I had family on the island? The questions seemed endless, but proved to be a motivator for my investigations, because I intended to get to the bottom of who my mother really was and what had really happened to her. And not even Dr. Death would stand in the way of that. Chapter 34. Lilia. Having finished a list of tasks that Kelvin had requested during my work-study shift, I hustled to the Adderley Memorial Room for some peace and quiet. There, I pulled my laptop from my bag and Googled Corbin, Dracadia Island. An obituary popped up for Arabella Corbin, who'd apparently passed just 4 years ago, preceded in death by her husband, Richard Corbin, survived by her only daughter, Vanessa Corbin, who'd gone missing in 2003. The attached picture offered an eerie glimpse of what my mother would have looked like had she aged to 74 years old. My grandmother. I tried to wrap my head around that, but it refused to go there. It refused to believe that my mother, a woman I'd adored, respected, trusted for so many years, had lied to me. She told me to my face that her mother had passed at an early age of a stroke, and that she'd never known much about her father either. For years, I'd believed that. Even if I assumed that I had been the reason my mother had left the study, why lie about her family? In what little I'd gleaned about the Corbins, I hadn't gotten the impression they were terrible people. Tears formed in my eyes as I Googled more pictures of Arabella. She appeared to have been an active woman, a potter, who'd often attended various craft shows on the island. She seemed to be well-liked and respected by her community, who'd spoken highly of her in the comments below the obituary. The younger photos showed her long auburn hair like mine, and bright blue eyes, beautiful and vibrant, just like my mother. Another article on her told of an estate sale held 2 years before her death. I peered at the address, jotting it down in a notebook. When I Googled the address, it appeared that the house had been in foreclosure at some point. As soon as work study ended, I headed for the bike rental shed with the address clutched in my palm. After the usual interrogation from the guard at the gate, I biked toward town. Past the strip of shops, I rounded the corner onto a dirt road that ended at a white picket fence. Beyond it stood a small yellow cottage with a white door and a bow window, half blocked by a bush with bright pink flowers. The courtyard in front surrounded a sturdy oak tree and a small white bench beneath it. Stone paths weaved through a wild mess of flowers, and birds flocked around a small stone fountain in their center. While it had a slightly unkempt and unlived-in appearance, it was no less adorable with the vast blue of the ocean behind it. After rubbing away some of the salty residue on the window, I peered through into an empty and quiet space that hadn't looked lived in for years. Keeping on with my nosing around, I unlatched the fence and padded through the small courtyard toward the back of the house. As soon as I rounded the corner, I skidded to a halt. The air caught in my lungs. A vibrant American elm with bent branches stood off to the side, a single swing hanging from a bough, and behind that, a cliff tapered down to a gorgeous ocean backdrop. My mother's painting. The sight of it stabbed my heart. A place I'd thought to be nothing but fictional in her head, one that had always brought me such peace and serenity, turned out to be the home where she'd grown up. How sad that it now stood alone and abandoned. Unwanted. I wished right then that I had the money to snatch it up and bring it back to life, to own a small piece of my past. A place where Bea and I could come and try to reconcile the mess our mother had left. I had to assume my mother had had her reasons, though. Maybe those reasons had something to do with Professor Bramwell's father and that study. Staring out over the ocean, taking in the serenity of the view, I recalled something from my reading. My grandmother had passed 4 years ago. Frowning, I tugged my phone from my pocket and opened the notes app where I'd jotted the few dates I'd gathered in my research. July 15th. Around that time, my mother had gone out of town to look into a specialist and financial assistance for the small benign tumor on Bee's eye. I'd been left in charge of Bee for those 2 days, so my mother could go alone, which I'd thought strange at the time. She'd never gone anywhere without the two of us. Although not life-threatening for my sister, the cyst had always been part of her insecurity, and perhaps even contributed to the anxiety she'd always felt around others. It had troubled my mother that we couldn't afford to have it removed, with us not having insurance or any means of paying for it. A little over a week later was about the time when my mother had first started showing signs of illness that we thought might have been something she'd picked up in her travels. From there, it had progressed over a period of weeks up until her death. Was it possible that my mother had returned home for the funeral? Maybe Bramwell and Crickson had had nothing to do with it. Had she somehow exposed herself to Noctisoma then? If so, how? Chapter 35. Lilia. 3 days had passed since the night I'd met with Mel. 3 days of obsessing over every smidge of information I could squeeze out of Google on my mother and grandparents. 3 days of questioning every moment of life, of trying to construct who Professor Bramwell's father was in my head. My whole world had turned upside down thanks to that file. The mental snapshots of my life up until that point seemed like an alternate ending to a story that had already been written. Who the hell was my mother? And why had she lied to me and Bee? How had she ended up at Dracadia University and connected to Warren Bramwell? Aside from the few articles covering the suicides, wherein the media was careful not to frame an accusation against Warren Bramwell, for legal reasons, I presumed, I'd found absolutely nothing useful on the man. Some published journals and his obituary, of course. but nothing significant. Not even those creepy websites that claim to have access to addresses and public records. Not one photo on Google Images, which was weird given that he had been a professor a number of years. As if he'd been wiped out of existence. Standing at the front of the class, Professor Bramwell delivered his lecture on cordyceps, a parasitic fungus that infected ants. It released a chemical that compelled the ant to climb a tree, where the fungus would emerge from its body to release spores that would fall to the ground and infect more ants. I couldn't help but stare at him, studying his body movements as he lectured. As riveting as the topic may have been, the only thought running through my head was, did the guy's father kill my mother? Of course, thoughts of Jenny Herrick then came to mind. Were both father and son killers? The accusations I'd heard had seemed nothing but speculation and rumor, hardly enough to pin a murder on the man, unless evidence had been intentionally overlooked. Even the Crixon study and my mother's involvement in that left little for me to connect Warren Bramwell to her death. It seemed my mother had gotten pregnant and left the study well before the other women had committed suicide. What if Mel was right, though? What if there was more information that I hadn't seen yet? What if they were powerful enough to get away with murder? To wipe all evidence clean? Was that what they'd done to my mother? I'd Googled Bramwell Jr. as well, and the results were much the same. Published research journals galore, and some doctoral dissertation award he'd won a few years back, but nothing too in-depth or personal. I couldn't leave it alone, though. Fate had brought me to Dracadia, placed me in the path of Professor Bramwell for a reason. For my mother's sake, I needed to move past the discomfort I felt around the man, or I'd never find out what had truly happened. At one point during the lecture, his eyes caught mine and something strange stirred in my stomach. His stare lingered with intensity, forcing me to look away, and when I did, I noticed Spencer's glancing between Bramwell and me, as if he'd caught on as well. I wondered how many other students noticed, and the thought heated my cheeks and stomach.
Miss Vespertine,
a deep voice called out, and I turned to see Professor Bramwell with his arms crossed at the front of the room staring up at me.
What reason would the fungus have for urging the ant to climb the tree instead of remaining on the ground?
A look around the room showed all eyes on me, and my heart pounded a chaotic beat inside my chest. I'd never been called on in a college class before, not unless I volunteered information on my own. Most professors only knew me as a number, not a face, and certainly not by name aside from Dr. Wilkins when I'd attended Covington. He'd never called on me in class, though. To expand dispersal and the chance of infecting another ant.
Precisely. And why is that important, Mr. Lippincott? Because the ant population is too high? Do you agree, Miss Vespertine?
While it may be true that parasites do help control insect populations, I think they tend to be far more selfish. What's important to cordyceps in particular is the need to fulfill its life cycle. And, of course, as you said at the beginning of the class, the most important function of any parasite is to secure its transmission to the next host. His lips curved into the kind of smile that made my stomach flutter and stoked some deep-seated guilt lingering there.
Very good, Miss Vespertine.
Assuming I did suspect that Crixon had had anything to do with my mother, and I wasn't sure it had, given the facts that didn't line up, it didn't make sense that I would harbor any reservations around my professor when the experiments took place 20 years ago. He couldn't have been more than 13 or 14 years old at the time. As he kept on with his lecture, I caught another glance toward me and the slightest curve of his lips that quickly faded when he turned his attention away. Perhaps something simmered there. A small flicker of interest on his part. Unless I was looking too deeply. Did I have it in me to flirt with my professor as a means to get closer to him? To seduce him? Absolutely not. The very thought had my guts in acrobatics. But the man was a closed vault, sealed with hot, molten steel that I'd never otherwise penetrate. The few interactions I'd seen between him and Gilchrist told me that not even sex managed to crack him. I'd have to appeal to that brain of his somehow. And in a way that didn't seem annoying. Doing well in his class wasn't enough. I needed him to see me as an exceptional student, as passionate about the organisms as he was. Harmless flirting, Nothing that would have gotten either of us kicked out. I just needed to gain his trust. At the end of class, I packed up my notebook and headed for the exit.
Miss Vespertine, a word, if you will.
Professor Bramwell said as I reached the door. Of course. The class cleared out, and once again Spencer shot me a glance full of disapproval. As Professor Bramwell gathered up his notes, I forced myself to ignore the way his muscles bulged at his biceps whenever he bent his arm, or the way he'd rolled up his sleeves to expose the map of veins in his forearms. And those hands. Hands that looked both delicate and barbaric, like they could gently wring the very life out of you. They were handsome hands, with trim nails and strong but slender fingers that I could imagine wielding a scalpel with utmost precision. An artist, no doubt. To flirt with him, even intellectually, I'd have to allow myself to appreciate these things about him. Allow myself to be attracted to a man who was otherwise off limits. A man that I imagined was powerful enough to have me kicked out of the school faster than I could say elitist privilege. And what then? If that happened, I'd never discover the truth about my mother.
I want to apologize for the other night in the library,
he said.
I didn't mean to speak so crass.
It's fine. Crass is polite where I'm from.
And where is that again?
The flexing of his left hand invited a momentary distraction. Covington?
Interesting.
How so?
You don't strike me as particularly hostile.
His eyes reminded me of pennies in a flame, a searing, metallic gaze that warmed my blood. I have a feisty side.
I don't doubt that.
And just like that, an invitation to flirt. Whether intentional or not, I couldn't tell, but it didn't matter. It was an opportunity to begin chipping at his armor. Flirt, Lilia. Say something back. Something witty, not stupid or awkward. It's rather presumptuous of you, though. Assuming that because I'm from a bad area, I should be automatically hostile.
The fight response is an ancient part of our defense mechanism that has allowed us to adapt, defend, survive. I'm certain it served you well.
You're speaking science again. His lip twitched as if he might smile, but didn't.
Always.
He leaned in, and I could smell the warm cinnamon on his breath over the delicious spice of his cologne.
I didn't say it was a bad thing.
His brow winged up as he straightened himself and shoved another notebook into his bag.
That will be all.
I willed the calming of my heart as I gave a sharp nod. Had he flirted back? I wasn't the wittiest or most in tune when it came to men, but the man was close enough to my face to have breached the invisible barrier between professor and student. Wait, can I ask you a question without you getting mad?
Probably not, but go on with your question.
A while back, when I told you that I believed my mother to be infected with Noctisoma, you asked if she was from here. Do you find it's prevalent in the locals?
Prevalent? Not as a general rule, no. They have their own folklore surrounding the berries. They believe they're the poison of bad spirits and tend to stay away from them. It's only ignorant tourists who occasionally consume the berries.
I'm pretty sure Andrea Kepling wasn't a tourist. I'd have mentioned my mother wasn't either, but no point wasting all of my newfound facts in the single encounter with him.
And I'm pretty sure we've already had this discussion. You're skirting the flames again, Miss Vespertine.
Behavioral fevering. I'm merely trying to rid myself of the endless questions plaguing my head. It was almost criminal how at ease I felt flirting over science, and worse, I didn't even feel like I was pretending. His jaw shifted, eyes narrowed with an amused appraisal. He crossed his arms and stared down at me, his muscles really working the fabric of the poor shirt that clung to him for dear life.
While I'm intrigued, I'm not at liberty to speak on this matter, and I'd appreciate no more inquiries.
He was intrigued. By what? The fact that Andrea wasn't a tourist? Or had I actually chipped a small divot in that steely exterior? Then just a general question about the organism itself. I swear it'll be my last.
What's your question?
Are there any cases of delayed symptoms? As in, over the course of years?
Years? No. The parasite settles in quickly.
Just as I recalled from lecture, but I wanted to confirm. So they don't go into a latency phase or something? He shook his head, stuffing a stack of papers into his bag.
Not that I've observed. The eggs do have a tough outer coating, like spores that allow them to resist hostile environments, such as extremely cold temperatures, for example.
The fact that the small bit of skin peeking between the top two unclasped buttons of his shirt could distract me, even a little bit, was a testament to the man's allure. The tone of his voice, his extensive knowledge, it was easy to get lost in his words.
But they eventually infect when conditions are favorable, and they are quite favorable in a human.
Which really didn't make sense where my mother was concerned. There was never a time throughout my childhood that I recalled my mother having had so much as a bad head cold, up until she'd gotten extremely ill 4 years ago. What had triggered her infection? Did it have anything to do with the Crixon Project? There just didn't seem to be enough evidence pointing me there.
Have I answered your endless stream of questions?
Not really, but I didn't want to annoy him with the barrage still kicking around inside my head. After all, the objective was to flirt, not piss him off. Yes, thank you. When he hoisted his leather bag over his head, crossing it over his chest, I caught a glimpse of the scar on his neck, reminding me the man had little reason to trust any of the students at the school, particularly a first year like me. He'd been branded, both physically and by rumor, thickening his armor, making him harder to crack. That he bothered to entertain my questions at all was surprising.
Stay out of trouble, curious moth,
he said as he strode for the door. Curious moth, a nickname. A fitting one, too, given the fact that I had no intentions of avoiding the flame.
Hey, smarty pants. Would it make me look bad?
Spencer said as he hustled to catch up to me after class. I can't make you look bad, only you hold the power. I chuckled, pushing my bag up onto my shoulder.
So, what's the deal with you and Bramwell?
What?
Like, the way he looks at you in class? It's weird.
He probably just noticed that I was kind of drifting off.
Nah, it's something else. Like guy body language. I can pick up on that shit.
I snorted at that, trying to imagine how those heated and heavy glances might have looked to Spencer. Is that the same as mansplaining?
I'd just be
careful, yes. I'm very careful. What is it with the warnings?
Has someone warned you against me?
As a matter of fact, yes.
Who? Mel?
I ground to a halt. While I didn't really need another round of drama thrown in my lap, particularly when it neither involved me nor had happened during my time at the university, perhaps I could clear some of the questions in my head. What about Mel? I asked, playing dumb. Cheeks puffed, he blew out a breath and stuffed his hands into his pockets.
I got drunk. I kissed her. She got squirrely when I didn't want anything to do with her, so she made up some story that I assaulted her. I get it. The kiss went too far, but nothing else happened.
Why would she make that up? Why would any woman?
I've known Mel for a couple years now. All I can tell you is she's not running on all cylinders.
I groaned and started toward my next class. Right. She must be psycho. A grip of my arm brought me to a stop before Spencer released me.
That's not what I'm saying. Stories are her thing. She likes to stir up conspiracy theories and dirt on everyone. I guarantee, if you piss her off, she'll go digging up shit on you too.
Yet you both agree that Dr. Bramwell has something to do with Jenny Herrick. If that's true, why take his class?
Because I need the credit for my degree. No other reason. And believe me, it isn't easy to sit in a class when you suspect someone of something like that. I try to see him as innocent because I know that my friend was wrong for what he did in retaliation, but the way he interacts with you?
Frowning, he shook his head.
It makes me question things all over again.
His interactions haven't been at all inappropriate. Not obviously so, anyway, except when he'd cursed in the library. But I don't need you hawking me either. I can take care of myself.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful here. On the contrary, I think of you as a friend, Lilia. That's all.
Is that all? As he opened his mouth, I interrupted, because I'm not interested in a relationship beyond that. His mouth clamped shut, and he cleared his throat.
I understand. Are we still on for tomorrow night?
Swallowing hard, I forced myself to not look surprised that I'd been caught off guard. Tomorrow night?
The charity ball?
Oh, right. I couldn't back out when he'd likely already paid for the dress. Sure. As friends, right?
Definitely.
Damn it. Chapter 36. Lilia. Billie Holiday droned on in the background of my dorm room as I jotted notes from my expository writing class. I had a meeting with my preceptor to discuss one of the topics that would make up a shit ton of essays I'd be expected to write before the big final at the end of the semester. I'd selected the evolution of biomedicine, thinking it'd be relevant to my degree. But I hadn't preempted that the class would be boring as hell and taught by a man who didn't know the meaning of inflection. The very thought of you came on, and I paused, the song taking me back to when I was younger, and my mother would play an entire record of Billie Holiday while she cooked. With a glass of wine in her hands, she'd dance around the kitchen, making an absolute mess that my sister and I would have to clean up. It had made me happy to see her so happy, though. Even at the prospect of having to scrub spaghetti sauce off the cupboards I'd loved when she cooked. Beside me sat a steaming mug of the Black Rock tea I'd gotten from the apothecary in town. I'd added the honey gums to it, which sweetened the bitter flavor, making it a delicious complement to my studies. A knock at the door interrupted my thoughts, and frowning, I shuffled across the room and swung the door open. Missy Finch stood in the hallway holding a long garment bag. Damn it. I'd hoped that maybe she'd forget me. Or maybe the dress would accidentally fall into a shredder. It's time, she squealed enthusiastically, and she pushed past me into my room. Let's try it on. Oh, this is actually a really bad time for me. I'm trying to write. It's imperative that I make sure it fits. I'm not dealing with the gate tyrant again. We're doing this now. Shoulders slumped in defeat, I watched her unzip the garment bag, and when she pulled the dress from inside, the air wheezed out of me. The dress was a long, deep burgundy satin skirt with delicate black tulle. Its off-the-shoulder bodice, adorned with black and burgundy star flowers and accented with gleaming diamonds, had my jaw cocked open. I thought the burgundy would complement your hair. Come, come, let's get undressed. That snapped me out of my trance. Wait, what? Here? I'll go into the bathroom and change. Her face pinched to a frown. Drag the train across a bathroom floor? I think not. With that, she draped the dress over my desk chair and turned around, crossing her arms with a huff. Ugh, ridiculous. Had we been in a proper boutique? She shook her head and huffed again. Ugh, never mind. Eyes on her, I quickly slid out of the ratty sweats I'd worn, which would undoubtedly had her nose turning up. Had she not been so excited about that damn dress. With nervous hands, I slid my legs into the unlatched dress and carefully pushed my arms through the sheer sleeves that also held the gorgeous star flower detail. Once dressed, I turned to face her, catching my reflection in the mirror. On a gasp, I stared at myself. Me, but so elegant. A far cry from the poor Covington girl who wore her mother's hand-me-downs. It's lovely, isn't it? Missy's voice, so close, snapped me out of my staring. Fits like a glove, she said, fidgeting with the buttons at my back. From the foot of the garment bag, she grabbed a black leather case, which she opened. Inside lay a beautiful diamond starflower choker with diamond leaves between each flower, and a set of diamond earrings to match. She removed my vial necklace, dropping it gently into my palm, and fastened the choker in its place. So beautiful and delicate against my skin tone. Perfect. Missy added. I couldn't stop staring. The dress held such a darkly alluring appeal that, when paired with the diamonds, made it almost seductive in itself. Way too much for a friendly date with Spencer. Way too much. I can't wear this. Excuse me? It's gorgeous. Absolutely stunning, but Spencer is going to get the wrong idea. She loosed what sounded like a cross between a laugh and a scoff. That is the tragedy of women, isn't it? We deny ourselves beauty for the sake of misleading men. Ugh, when she put it that way, it did sound ridiculous. Still, I didn't want to draw attention from anyone. I get that, but I feel like an oyster without a pearl. Missy's lips curved to a smile, and she brushed a strand of hair behind my ear. And what of the other oysters once their pearls are plucked? I'd have hated getting into an argument with her because the woman probably had some plucky comebacks, judging by the last two she'd thrown at me. I can't get over how much you look like her. Vanessa, the woman I know who she is. Were you friends? Hardly. She was my competition in everything. Sports, academics, men. Things that don't really matter anymore. She twisted around and cracked open my caboodle, which held small things like the mascara I almost never wore, chapstick, some hair ties, and a lipstick the same shade that my mother would never leave the house without wearing. Missy popped its cap and twisted it up, revealing a deep berry color, and with a glint of intrigue, she plastered it onto my lips. She was my mother, I finally confessed before rubbing my lips together. Do you know if she has any family on the island? I only wore lipstick on rare occasions, but as I stared at myself in the mirror, I couldn't help but appreciate how perfectly it matched and added a much-needed pop of color to my face. Lips pressed to a hard line, she shook her head. Her mother passed about 4 years ago. Her father, about a year before that. Good, honest people. Fashion challenged, of course, but good people. That was all the family she had? As far as I know. The Corbins were a pretty tightly knit family. I personally found it a little unbelievable that Vanessa would up and leave, just completely out of character. Did you know a June Galloway? She snorted and rolled her eyes. Everyone knew June. A bit strange, that one. She hung out with the burnouts, mostly. Was she friends with my mother? Not that I know of. Your mother was a bit more goody-two-shoes than June. Do you know if either of them attended Dracadia? She made a face like I'd said something outrageous and let out a snooty chuckle. No, I don't think so. The school was a little out of budget for their families, particularly June's. Only the elite and wealthy attended this school, and... you. Thanks, I said in a flat tone. It wasn't an insult. She circled me, fussing with the dress. I love money, but wealth is exhausting. The look on your face when you first saw yourself in this dress is something I rarely see. I found it gratifying. I do love the dress. Good. Brow winged up, she sauntered in front of me. Wear it. Feel beautiful. And for God's sake, Lilia, enjoy yourself.
Chapter 37, Devrick.
Stay away from me! Stay the fuck away!
Wild, silvery eyes glowed in the dark from where Barletta crouched in the corner of a cell.
Don't touch me!
A sob ripped from his chest, and he clawed at the wall, his back hunched further than the last time I'd fed him. Dried blood coated his nails, the tips of which had broken off with his scratching. His body held long, red marks, slices he must have somehow made in his skin. Frowning, I scanned over the room, finding nothing but the mattress, the Bible he'd requested on my last visit, and a small plastic comb filled with hair that had fallen out. How did you get those marks? A whimper echoed in his cell as he shook his head and scratched at the walls harder than before.
Please, he whispered in a shaky voice. Please don't hurt me.
At that point in the infection, I'd have expected more hostility out of him, more desperation for escape. The cowering in the corner was something new. Would you like some water? He breathed hard, clearly scared shitless for some reason, as he clung tighter to the wall, his eyes shifting. Impatient, I strode toward the hose and filled a cup halfway, just like last time. When I returned to his cell, he didn't bother to come closer when I held the paper cup through the bars, so I set it down on the floor and stepped back. He took an uncertain lurch forward, then halted, eyes flitting from me to the cage, as though gauging the distance. His behavior reminded me of a small animal, like a rodent. I'm not going to touch you. I've no idea why you're so skittish all of a sudden. Scrambling on all fours, he drove forward, swiped up the cup, and gulped back the proffered fluids. A long scratch ran the length of his wrist, from the bottom of his palm to his elbow, as if he'd toyed with the idea of cutting deeper. Again, I scanned over his cell in search of whatever he might have used to cut himself, but still only found the comb as the sharpest object.